Hi, and welcome to another episode of Django Chat, a podcast on the Django web framework. I'm Carlton Gibson, joined as ever by Will Vincent. Hello, Will.
Hi, Carlton.
Hello, Will. And today we've got with us Jacob Kaplan-Moss, who's the current board member of the DSF, was one of the original contributors to Django, and was a one-time co-benign dictator for life, BDFL. I can say the acronym, benevolent. But what does it stand for?
Hi, guys. Hello, thanks Jacob. For having me.
Benevolent, right. Thank you for coming on. So look, we always ask, and we know we're excited to have you on, but for listeners who don't know, could you give us your backstory? And I mean, we normally ask people how they got involved with Django, but like, that's a slightly stranger question.
Yeah. So in 2004, I was living in New Jersey and working in New York City for a digital design agency, building websites in PHP and really hating it. And hacking on not PHP as much as the company. The language was whatever, but the company was terrible. And I was starting to get involved in Python. I had been following Python people online for a while, and two of the people who I followed, whose blogs I read, were these guys, Adrian Hollavati and Simon Willison. And I hadn't clocked that they worked together until one day I saw a really interesting job posting on Simon's blog and read it and went, huh, that sounds like, you know, that matches a lot of things that I would like to do. And then I clicked a little lower in my RSS reader and I saw the same job posting from Adrian and went, wait, these guys work together. This is the same job. And got really excited, sent in a resume, got a call back from their boss, a guy named Rob Curley, that afternoon. We talked for a while and he said, okay, great. We've got to get you out to Kansas for an interview. And that was the first time I realized that this job was actually in Kansas. I hadn't even paid attention to that part. I had gotten so excited about the potential of getting to write web stuff in Python that I just completely ignored where the job was. When I interviewed, I guess they liked me, offered me the job. When I started there, what I found was that Adrian and Simon had been working for about a year at that point on a set of tools to build web applications in Python. It didn't have a name yet. We called it the CMS. What more should I tell you about that time?
Well, I guess for me, the interesting bit is the open sourcing and then, you know, this. So I got into Django. I had the book that you'd written. You and Adrian wrote this book and it was, and I was doing PHP development as well. And it was written for people who kind of knew a bit of PHP and here's Django. And it was, you know, open-minded. So that kind of thread through there was, for me, was, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that was, I think, as far as I know, both Adrian and Simon had been working in PHP before starting to write what became Django in Python. And yeah, there were, I think, a number of things in the early framework that was sort of like influenced by design decisions in PHP, but trying to, build them in a way that worked with Python that sort of fit, this was right around the time of like the early web standards movement. And so there was this idea starting to percolate at the time of like, separation of presentation and content. And that was something that there's sort of a similar idea in sort of the back end of sort of separation of like business logic from display logic or something like that, which most frameworks at the time didn't really do. And like a lot of, I think, the criticism about PHP as a web development language has less to do with the actual like language ergonomics and more around sort of the affordances of just kind of mixing everything together in this one file that makes it really hard to maintain.
Well, it was kind of glorious in a way. You'd be writing your HTML page and then you just, oh, I just need this to, I need a bit of logic here.
Right.
Angle bracket, question mark, PHP, and you're off.
Right. Well, it's funny because, okay, so like skipping ahead a little bit, right, we get to this things that one of the things I'm really excited about right now, a Tailwind and HTMX, which are in a way like going back to like, hey, let's put more things into our HTML file. But now we're doing it in a way that's informed by several decades of web development and isn't I don't think creating some of the sort of maintainability nightmares that we had back in the day. You know, the big challenge that was facing the Lawrence Journal World, the locally owned newspaper where Jenga was created, was, you know, small local newspaper, not a lot of resources, just a handful of developers, with really lofty ambitions. You know, Adrian especially was kind of one of the creators of the sort of idea of data journalism. I think he coined that term. And we had these ambitions of building these sort of interactive news apps that, you know, let readers not just read a story, but actually explore the underlying data. You know, we did a story about the university's use of private airplanes to fly various people around, most notably coaches and student athletes for like recruiting purposes, which is a cool story. That's an interesting story. But we did a thing that most newspapers wouldn't have done, where we actually ingested all of the flight data on all of the flights that the university's planes had taken in the last few years and created an app that people could click around and see and actually look at those flights for themselves and see the dates. And we didn't have passenger manifests, but you could infer from like recruiting information, oh, this is, you know, this is head coach Bill Self flying to Texas to recruit some, you know, hot high school basketball player. And that we wanted to be able to build that stuff, but we also didn't have like a big team. And so maintainability was like a really big deal. You have to be able to sort of, you know, publish these applications on a deadline, but then they have to like, if you find a bug 3 years later and you come back to a big mess of spaghetti code, you're in a lot of trouble. So we were trying to really balance this idea of being able to develop something really quickly on, on publication deadlines, but also following our perception of sort of best practices at the time.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Because the last year I've been bootstrapping an application single-handedly, and it's only now with like the HTMXs and the Tailwinds and the Alpines of the world around that that's sort of realistic again. 2 years ago with React, I just couldn't have done it because there's too many moving parts. But it's like, actually, it's really possible with Django to build something small and tight with a very small team, which I think now that money's not free anymore is kind of interesting as well.
That for me is one of the most like gratifying and satisfying parts of, you know, looking back on what's getting close to 20 years of Django at this point, is how through everything that has changed, that core of like, I want to build something really quickly that is still maintainable and still easy to read the code, you know, years, heck, even decades later, like that, we've somehow managed to stay true to that core principle. And that makes me really happy. And it makes me feel like we were actually onto something.
Yeah. Good. On this podcast, we've often talked about how someone fires up a project from 2011 and they add an on delete clause and it just works. And that's kind of thing. On this topic, just before I let Will jump in with something or other, but the recently there's been discussion about the Django template language again and comparing it to other Django template languages which let you do more things. But coming from PHP, it's one of the reasons why I still choose to use the Django template language, is that it's very restrictive in what it lets you do. You have to create a template tag, or you have to do it in the view. And I don't know if you still have thoughts on that. Do you still like it, or do you prefer other things? Or
so, yeah, I think it's always this tension, right? Like, I think we were more dogmatic about the sort of restrictive nature. We've become less dogmatic about that restrictive nature over the years. I think this idea of like separation of presentation from content was, or presentation from logic was like a really important one for us early on. And it matched the way that a lot of web teams were composed at the time. You had a pretty clear dividing line between sort of designers and developers. That was a fairly stark line. And so, you know, when we were building the template language, we were thinking about people who didn't have sort of experience in traditional programming language. They knew HTML and CSS, usually better than we did. But like JavaScript, kind of wasn't a thing. Right. Yet. I mean, it was there and people used it a little bit, but mostly to do obnoxious things like marquees or whatever. Yeah. it wasn't at all anything like it was today. And so we were building a language for, you know, non-developers. I think these days, front-end developers, designers, back-end developers, it's a much more of a spectrum of a sort of bleed through sort of, you know, set of skills. You know, there isn't that clear dividing line. And I think it makes less sense. I think it's very, very hard to do any sort of web development without at least some foundation in, you know, what we're trying to, you know, a more traditional programming language, usually JavaScript, right? Like, so what if I'm working on a web development team, what I can expect from the more front-end oriented people of my team is a lot closer to what I can expect from the sort of more back-end oriented folks on my team. So it makes more sense. And so in that context, someone with sort of a more, you know, traditional set of programming skills under their belt is going to feel chafed by, you know, the constraints of the early template programming language. These days, honestly, I usually recommend that most teams start with Jinja as the template language. I love that that's an option in Django that you can sort of pick and choose. I still use the Django template language myself because, you know, I've been using this particular hammer for a really long time. It's very hard to change those habits. I think if I was creating a framework from scratch today, I would not be building my own template language. I would be using Jinja. Jinja's great. Some of the design decisions are a little bit different than the ones that like I would make, the ones we made back then, but not in a way that's like meaningful or important.
Right, but there are always design decisions, right? Everything you choose, there's something that you wouldn't do if you did again, but you choose something else.
I mean, for me, it's really important to identify the difference between like, I would have done it differently, but it's fine. And like, no, I actually have a problem with this. And Jinja is definitely in the former category. Like, I would have made different decisions, but not in an actually meaningful way. Just in sort of the sense of like, we're all different people, and we have slightly different tastes. There's absolutely nothing wrong with it, and there are a number of things that are, you know, actually significantly better about it. Partials being a big one that I know you you think about too.
The template partials package is just, I'm just in love with that, and I'm hoping we can get that into 5.2. I'm going to put a proposal to put it in.
Oh, cool.
Because it's like just literally one tag. And we did a bit of preparatory work in 5.1, which is under the covers, and then hopefully 5.2. It, you know.
Oh, cool. That's awesome.
That's my goal anyway.
I wanted to give a plug. We'll put it in the show notes. You gave a PyCon 2017 tutorial called Let's Build a Web Framework, talking about, I think there were six kind of big design decisions. And certainly for me, like I refer people to that all the time, because I think that's the first time, that's a way to think about like, well, what even is a web framework and what are the decisions? And then, as you said, like some things vary and most things are, you know, what's really important versus what's design. But it's a really helpful, once you can get to thinking of it that way, that's a big leap in understand, you know, thinking about Django or any other web framework. Because when you start out, you know, maybe you're new to Python and you're new to web and you're new to Django, and it's really just everything is magical. But like getting to the point where you can be like, oh yeah, templating, we're going to need a solution there. ORM, we need a solution there. That's when you can abstract it away and I think have a bigger picture of it all. So anyways, I highly recommend that. It's 3 hours long. You can kind of skip some of the code yourself parts, but I've watched that multiple times. That's a fantastic resource for people.
Awesome. I'd forgotten about that. That'd be fun to revisit that and see if I still agree with that 2017 Jinja.
Yeah, I think you were mentioned also the bit about Jinja and the templates in that one. We want to talk about the current day, but as a way to get there, one of the things that impressed me so much about Django community is the fact that you and Adrian both didn't feel like it was yours to hang on to and for forever and ever. I mean, you set up the Django Software Foundation pretty early on, and it's still a relatively uncommon model for open source projects. Like most seem to be solo person who monetizes it in some way. I mean, like Laravel being an example, or something that was open sourced inside a company, React, Angular. I guess, could you talk about why did you decide to do that? And what was that process like? And that'll lead us to today where you're back on the board of the Django Software Foundation.
Yeah. So at the time, Django was not, you know, was not the success that it was, that it is today. And honestly, we had no idea. If you had asked me in 2005, like what, you know, what my sort of like greatest ambition for Django was, I would have painted a picture that's like 10% of what, of like where it's gone now. I mean, like multiple, not just one space agency, but multiple space agencies use Django. Like that's, if you had gone back in time to tell me that in 2005, I would have completely not believed you. We were thinking at the time about adoption by other news organizations, and news organizations are like weirdly competitive. If you think software developers have not invented here syndrome, like wait until you meet reporters. The fact that Django was owned by another newspaper, even if it wasn't in any way a competitor, was enough to prevent, or at least in our minds, felt like enough to prevent people from using it. I think we also kind of read the writing on the wall for, look, like a small family-owned local newspaper. You know, it was a little more common back then, but it was already on its way out. And indeed, like the Lawrence Journal World is no longer owned by the Simons family, by the local family that owned it. It's owned by, is it Gannett now? It's owned by one of the big conglomerates. I think we not saw that coming, but like knew that that was a predictable outcome for, you know, for the paper. And we wanted to sort of ensure that, there was sort of a neutral owner of the intellectual property. That was really our concern. We weren't thinking about support. We weren't thinking about all the sort of sustainability stuff that's like a big deal today. We weren't thinking about fundraising. We were purely thinking about IP ownership. And at the time, the PSF did exist, but they weren't doing any sort of fiscal sponsorship. I can't remember if we approached the PSF about possibly donating the IP to them, but I think it would have been a non-starter. I don't think there was like a model for that. The only software foundation, at least that I was aware of at the time, was the Apache Software Foundation. And they have a list of rules to join the ASF that's about a million miles long. It's really intended for like large companies that want to sort of like, not just like donate IP and have like a stable owner, but like really like run a project under the auspices of the ASF. It's not, I don't think there's anything wrong with the rules they have, but it's not intended for like what at the time was like a small project, right? A handful of folks in a literal basement. Our office was, in fact, the basement of the news center. So forming our own nonprofit kind of seemed like the only viable path forward at the time. It was sort of something, we did reluctantly and kind of perfunctorily. I made so many mistakes as the first president of the DSF. It's like pretty embarrassing to look back at. Somehow it worked out.
Well, I think the fact that you had that organization, you know, that both you and Adrian were community focused from the beginning and that you had the organization meant that it wasn't the case that if the two of you lost interest or had to step away, the project would die. Right. Whereas that seems to be the case with most other ones where, if it's one person, you know, how do you maintain that 20 years?
We were heavily influenced by a guy named Carl Fogel, who wrote a book called Producing Open Source Software. We knew him a little bit personally and also both read his book and were really sort of influenced by, I don't know, like even though we didn't have grandiose ambitions, it felt important to have, have good governance. And like, I've learned a huge amount about open source and community governance since then. Like I said, I made a lot of mistakes, but you know, they weren't mistakes out of like lack of care or lack of attention. They were beginner mistakes, if I, you know.
But those are allowed, right? Beginner mistakes were allowed.
Yeah, totally. You know, and I don't, you know, in the same way that like, if you look at code that you wrote 5 years ago and aren't embarrassed, it means you're not learning anything. If I look at, like, you know, leadership decisions I made 5 years ago and I'm not embarrassed, it means I haven't learned anything. I don't feel like bad or guilty about it, but like, I think there's a lot of like myth making that happens around these types of things. I think it's important to like acknowledge that we barely knew what we were doing.
Yeah, right. Okay.
'Cause it's easy to look back and like draw this like really clear story and like say like, oh yeah, of course we knew that, you know, the Federal Election Committee would be using Django in the 2000s. No, we didn't. We had no clue.
Yes. Yeah. No, entirely.
Well, sorry, I was going to ask one sort of opinionated question, which is, if you had to say, you know, why Django grew the way it did, there's the Django being awesome component, and then there's also the rise of Python itself. Where do you put that balance, right? Because there were some other ways to build a website in Python back then, but I think it's hard for people to understand that there were very few tools. Like, this is like Ruby and Rails was just getting started. Like, this is before this idea of a batteries included framework even existed. It was so much more manual. So I guess to put it to you, what's the question? I mean, you know, both Python and Django have really gone up and to the right. And do you see anything specifically that Django did that some of the other projects from back then didn't, that besides just being around, that contributed to a success?
Yeah, I mean, like, I've obviously thought about this a lot, why did we succeed to the level that we did? And like, you know, a lot of it is luck, to be sure. You know, timing was everything to a large degree, right? Like, you mentioned Ruby on Rails, and I think that's a good sort of starting point to think about it, because it incorporates both the luck and some of the deliberate decisions. We were lucky in that we were able to release Django relatively shortly after Rails came out, maybe about a year. And we were and we made deliberate decisions that were influenced by Rails. Rails was really the first back-end web tool, at least that I was aware of, that focused on like what today we would call developer experience. You know, I don't think we had a strong idea of like an opinionated sort of on Rails. the name was chosen for a reason.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, you know, sort of development path. Web development was really hard at the time, especially in Python. There was a lot of like, what is Python's answer to Rails? Python developers were leaving Python in 2004, 2005 to go to Rails. Because again, like, back to the different design decisions, Ruby and Python are totally one of those things. They're different design decisions, but neither is like better or worse. And so to a Python developer looking at hard web development in Python or easy web development in a language that's like close enough to Python to basically be like good enough, a lot of people chose to make that leap. So yeah, certainly like a thing we did differently from a lot of other frameworks at the time was focusing on sort of like ease of use and developer experience. We also made a really deliberate decision to focus on documentation, which is still unusual, and still to this day sets us apart. You know, which is pretty wild. But to your point about Python, I do think there was like a there was a sort of like, trying not to use the word synergy because I hate that word, but that's the right word. There was a synergy there. There was, you know, Python was growing but didn't have a web story. And then Django comes along and now there's a web story. And so that, you know, the fact that Python was sort of starting to evolve into the everything language, everything includes web development. And so, you know, you have this sort of like positive feedback loop of like people learn Python for, you know, some other reason. They learn Python in college for doing statistics, and then they get a job and they're still doing statistics, but suddenly they need to do, excuse me.
That's okay.
Suddenly they need to do a web app as well. And hey, look, there's Django. And so they stay with Python. And so then Python continues to grow. And so I think that there was sort of like a really, I think not to get too grandiose about it, but I think Django deserves some credit for the growth of Python. And I think Python deserves the growth of Python into every domain deserves a lot of credit for the growth of Django.
Yeah, I mean, with machine learning and data science and all of that coming so big now, like the Django picks up a lot of traffic that way, I think, as well as the other web frameworks.
Yeah, exactly.
Let's pull forward to, because you've been away from the board, and then a couple of years ago you came back onto the board. This is your second year now on the board. So, and I guess listening to the last few minutes where you've been talking about the development and the growth, the one thing that kind of sticks with me is that Django's kind of that Python 2-3 thing. We've kind of avoided that. There's been no kind of equivalent in Django for at least since the 1.8 days, 1.9, 1.10. It's increasingly stable. And so as a sort of old hand, I'm really like, oh, that's for me, that's kind of Django's killer feature is its stability. But it's also a really exciting time in web development. And so how do we now balance those kind of two really important things? One is, you know, Django stability and its, you know, API stability policy and all the rest of it, the long-term release, long-term support LTSs. But we want to keep growing and we want Django to keep pushing forward at the front of web development. Not, you know, we use this phrase boring from that talk about use boring technology because it's safe. But we don't want Django to be boring. It's not boring. It's super exciting. How do we balance those? What's your, you know, why did you come back to the board? Like,
it's funny. Those two things were not related in sort of the opportunities facing Django sort of from a technical standpoint and the reasons that I returned to the board were not related in my head at the time, although I'm wondering if there was something kind of knocking around connecting the two. I think so. I'll talk about the board stuff. I'll talk about why I came back to the board in a minute, but like, you know, yeah, that tension between, you know, stability, being conservative about introducing new features and still wanting to be, you know, trying to sort of like be maybe not cutting edge. I don't think we've ever wanted to be cutting edge, but I think we've always wanted to be, you know, on like the leading edge of the adoption curve of web technologies. Right. That's been a tension in Django development the entire time. I mean, like, as early as the first couple of years after Django was out, I remember having conversations about whether Django was moving too slow, right? Like, you know, like, oh yeah. I mean, it's been all along. And like, you know, there are upsides and downsides, right? Like, there was a lot of talk. Oh, I want to say, you know, as sort of like React primarily, but other similar frameworks, Vue, et cetera, were starting to become super popular. There was a lot of talk about like maybe Django should just drop the template engine, drop any HTML generation, become just a pure API driven web framework. I'm glad we didn't do that. You know, we're starting to see a lot of the limitations of, you know, these sort of really heavyweight front end frameworks in performance, in performance of the website and in performance of the people developing the website. Both we're seeing some real struggles there. And that's not to say that's not like a useful niche, right? Like, you know, Fast API, for example, like shows off what you can do when you start with a sort of API first or kind of API only. Not API only, but I would say API first kind of approach to building a framework. And I'm super glad something like that exists, but I'm also really glad that that's not the direction that Django went in. You know, going back even before there was like, remember there was a brief moment when object-oriented databases were like this huge thing. There was a discussion about like, should Django, you know, change to support object-oriented databases? I'm glad we stuck with the boring old SQL because turns out works super well, or non-relational databases after that, you know, like it is very, very hard in the middle of a bubble to tell the difference between a fad and something that's actually going to stick around. For all the talk of, you know, HTMX and Alpine, I'm not convinced it's not a fad. I don't think it is. Like, my feeling and my judgment is that, no, this is actually a solution to a problem we've had for a really long time and not sort of like a flash in the pan. But, dude, I've been wrong about that before.
Yeah.
So I'm not convinced. So, yeah, we are at an inflection point. And I think we're at a point where we've swung a little too much towards the conservatism angle over the last few years. And I think some of that is related to a lot of people who have been deeply involved in Django development have been stepping back over the last few years for all sorts of reasons, in small ways and in big ways. I mean, Carlton, you're one of them. You used to be a Django fellow and now you're not, although you're still doing a bunch of, arguably you're doing more work on Django now than you were when you were a fellow. So
I actually get to work on Django unfair, now. So,
right. But anyway, my point is that, like, I think we're at an interesting inflection point. One of the reasons I wanted to come on the podcast is because we're at this point where, things have slowed somewhat. A lot of longtime people who have been involved are, you know, stepping back, being less involved. And there's a lot of excitement in the community. DjangoCon US this year had so many new faces and so much energy and so much just like raw, like, I want to do stuff, but it's always been hard to get from, you know, I'm excited, I've written a little patch or I've done a third party package, to like really being involved in the core community. And so I think the challenge facing Django's leadership right now is like, how do we get that new blood into the community? Because with that new blood are going to come the types of things that are going to sort of revitalize and make, you know, move the technology forward. The technology always follows the people. Django's not going to, you know, my pet feature is I want Django to have first class HTMX support. I want that to be built into core. But like, that's not going to just sort of magically happen. Someone's going to do that.
Yeah.
And that someone is probably going to be someone, hopefully is going to be someone relatively new to Django development. We're at a moment where there's a lot of opportunity, but also a lot of sort of uncertainty and like a bit of a leadership vacuum. And that's the thing that's like the deepest on my mind these days.
Okay. So the words you used there were leadership vacuum. And I want to, it's a question I have for you. It's about the contrast between the BDFL model, the dictator life model, and then the sort of community consensus model, because both have benefits, right? What's wrong with the BDFL model? And then what is it that we can, how do we inject a bit of the kind of direction giving that can bring back?
So my experience of leadership over, you know, the 20 years that I've been in any sort of like leadership role is that every time I step back and give power to someone else, it's a net positive.
Yeah, right. Okay.
Which says some interesting things about my sort of direct leadership ability.
No, but it's not about you.
You know, I'm not to be self-deprecating about it. I think what it says to me is that I'm a better coach, sponsor, mentor than I am sort of a more directive style leader. And like, that is a thing that I've realized about myself and like has helped me be a lot more effective over the last few years. It's one of the reasons why I felt sort of ready to take a leadership role on the board. It's like, I understand my own leadership style and my own leadership successes now. And I think the BDFL model only works as long as you have a more directive and opinionated style leader. And only as long as that person has the attention and the time and the like lack of burnout to give that attention, right? And Adrian and I didn't, right? I mean, there was a long period of stagnation in Django development because everyone was waiting on Adrian and I to make decisions, and neither of them, we didn't want to. We weren't interested in that. And it wasn't until the sort of, you know, it wasn't until we stepped back and abdicated that power that things like really took off, honestly.
I like, there was a gag I saw on, I know, Foster Don or somewhere the other day. It was a while back, but the idea is that the reason that a project needs a BDFL is the very reason BDFL stepped down. Because
yeah, I mean, like, it is very, very rare to find someone who is a good leader in a dictatorial model and is not doing it because of their ego or doing it because they're a jerk. I mean, like, gosh, Guido is truly a special person to have been the BDFL for Python for so long with a long track record of like being nice.
Yeah.
Like usually BDFLs are either ineffective or assholes. And, you know, like I was pretty ineffective. I'd rather fail in that way than in the other way. But like, it is super rare for that model to actually survive for a long time. I want to pick up on one thing you said though, because you use the word consensus, and that this is the other reason why I wanted to sort of return to a leadership position. My understanding of consensus has changed a lot over the last decade or so, having done a lot more like, you know, community building, community governance, community leadership, honestly, mostly in ways outside of technology, other nonprofit work, other sort of like intentional community type stuff. And I think most people have this naive idea of consensus meaning sort of like everyone agrees. And that's not what consensus means as practiced by organizations that truly have like a mature and sort of well-developed consensus driven process. Consensus is not everyone agrees. Consensus is a group of people who are, they are more aligned with the process than they are with any particular outcome. And they've all agreed on how decisions will be made. The goal is to make a decision that makes everyone happy or at least content. But when there are situations where not everyone does agree, you've laid the groundwork ahead of time that everyone is more invested in the community health than they are in getting their own way. And so you have all sorts of mechanisms like standing aside, which is a way of saying like, I don't agree, but I'm not going to block this. You have various mechanisms for sort of hard and soft blocks and what needs to happen to overcome the blocks. And I think those sorts of things are the type of work that Django needs to invest in. We sort of replaced the BDFL model with this rotating technical board, now called the steering committee. Which is an improvement over a BDFL model, but it's still not more largely community driven. And I think in my mind, the next iteration of Django's governance model involves a broader slice of the community involved in decision-making processes. Another board member, Thibaut, just held a Django roadmap sort of brainstorming session, which is awesome. So great. I'm so glad that he did that. I hope that something like that becomes a more consistent and even like binding part of Django's governance model. Not binding in the sense of like, we're all volunteers. We're mostly volunteers. We can't force anyone to do anything, but having a well-defined roadmap and a process for developing that roadmap that listens to as many voices from the community as possible, I think is sort of the big missing piece from Django's governance right now.
Yeah. I mean, so I went to that session and the 10, yeah. There's a post on the forum about it, which gives the details, but there were 10, 15 ideas came out and all of them are like, you know, positive. There's,
yeah.
you know, whether you agree with every single one or not, it's like, you know what, if Django had all of these, that would be a massive win. That would be a massive move forward. Even if it, you know, the cost of it was the ones I didn't want as well. I'd take that in a blink, you know.
Yeah.
It's so having a way of driving that, because what's happened in the recent past is people have felt very frustrated that we can't get this agreement of exactly how to proceed on a feature. And so it just kind of hits into the long grass. And in some ways that served Django well in that we haven't gone down various dead ends. But in other ways, it does risk atrophy.
Yes, precisely. Yeah. And like, I think that, I think that, you know, we, like, look, we've made mistakes before. We've put things in Django that turned out to not be a great idea from, you know, in with 2020 hindsight and in retrospect. And I'm not going to mention any specifics because I don't want to like call anyone out, and I might be wrong. But like, I feel like we've made some mistakes, and it's all mostly been fine. And so like, I think we need to like ratchet up our risk tolerance like just a little bit, you know, like. You know, of those 15 ideas, is one or two of them going to prove to be a bad idea in the future? Maybe.
Absolutely.
But like, whatever, we can recover from that. It's just code.
Yeah.
So I wanted to ask you about, so there's deciding and then there's doing. And we just had, last week we interviewed Deb Nicholson, who's the executive director of the PSF. And she was talking about things that an executive director does where, or well, the PSF more broadly, the board there, which I know you've been on, is decides and others largely implement. Sometimes it's board members on a working group. When I was on the Django board, I felt like the board kind of had to do both. And as for volunteers, that's a lot to ask. I mean, I know you're now the treasurer again, which is the role I had, and you know that that's a lot of work. That's a long-winded way of saying, how do you feel about? Do you feel like there's a disconnect there between the deciding and doing? Because me personally, I came away, part of the reason I stepped down is I felt like it's more than a volunteer can do to go to the next level, these organizational things, fundraising that people keep talking about absent an executive director. But I've been away from the board 2 years, and I'm curious what your feelings are on that.
Yeah, this was my main motivation for returning to the board. So there are two models of two sort of big buckets you can put nonprofit boards into. You can have an activist board where the board does the work of the nonprofit. If someone needs to file taxes, the treasurer fills out the tax form. If someone needs to talk to a major donor, a board member calls that major donor and has a conversation with them, right? The board does the work. The other model is a directive board. The board directs. The board sets high-level goals. The board allocates money. The board makes large strategic decisions. But the most of the work is actually delegated. The board delegates most of its power to individuals, to employees, to working groups, et cetera, et cetera. This is not a consensus opinion of all nonprofit people, but my opinion is that the directive board is more effective and then as a long-term better model for a stable, functional, you know, effective nonprofit organization. Django, the DSF has historically been an activist board and has made a couple of steps towards being a directive board. You know, you mentioned that being the treasurer is a lot of work. It's actually not my experience because we've hired an assistant who does the vast majority of that work.
Yeah, well, I guess when I joined, it'd been she wasn't part-time doing that role. So it was, I could feel why. And yeah, the fact that Catherine has an accounting degree and is amazing makes it doable for anyone, for me or anyone else. Yeah.
And that's like a small scale model of like what I mean by like, like, why should we be so shocked that hiring someone with an accounting background to do accounting is more effective than having a software engineer with no accounting experience do the work? Like, that's not surprising. That's the least surprising piece of information we could possibly have. So, and that's a small scale model for where I'm hoping to take the DSF and the board's pretty aligned on this. This is not a like a me fighting the board thing. This is pretty much all of us have this same idea that like the DSF will be more effective. Django itself will be more healthy if the board can sort of transition to a more community driven and more broader base of people working on DSF stuff. So we've done. I want to plug a couple things that we've done over the last 6 months to sort of like to that end. The first is that we've made becoming a DSF member easier. It used to be that in order to be a DSF member, you had DSF membership recognized contribution of intellectual property. So you had to write code or write documentation, or sometimes we sort of would stretch to like include conference organizing as like, I guess you're creating videos, so that's IP. That was a very narrow and restrictive version of what being a DSF member was. The new definition is basically contributing to Django's mission, which is supporting the framework, which is advancing web development, which is protecting the intellectual property of Django. That's a pretty broad set of activities, and it enables us to really like admit people as members with all sorts of different backgrounds. Like by the new definition, if pretty much anyone who works on an open source Python package is now eligible to be a DSF member, because can you use that package with Django?
Well, yes, you can.
And you've contributed to sort of advancing the state of the framework. Done. Anyone who, writes a series of blog posts about Django is eligible. Anyone who records a podcast about Django is eligible. We've sort of much broadened that definition in the hopes of getting a lot more people and a lot more voices sort of into the community and giving them a direct vote and a voice. The other thing that we've done is we've created a structure for creating working groups. And this hasn't moved as fast as I would have liked, but it is moving along a little bit. We've created a mechanism basically for people to spin up working groups and to ask for delegated powers from the board. And it's pretty broad. That can really be anything, right? The board can approve a budget, and then the working group can go directly spend that budget without individual approval from the board, right? The working group can ask for, we've just formed a sort of a social media working group to sort of own Django's sort of social media presence. And if you look at that group's charter, we've sort of enumerated a list of things that working group can do without explicit approval from the board. The board does not need to approve every tweet. The board does not need to approve who we follow or what social, or like what platforms we post things to, et cetera, et cetera. There are a couple of lines that we've reserved for the board, like the board is reserving the right to review any sort of like sponsored post type activity, because we're not sure if that's something that we necessarily want to be doing, and if we do, how we want to be doing that. So we've sort of delineated some lines, but that's kind of the model for where I'm hoping a lot of leadership at the sort of DSF level will happen. I'm sort of hoping that a lot of the sort of informal groups that we've spun up around Django, the ops team, the security team, those sort of groups will kind of eventually reform as working groups, so that we can more like we ought to just give the ops team a designated budget. We shouldn't have to approve spending on hosting. They should just have a credit card and like buy the things they need to buy to host the Django site. Right. There's no need for that to be a board decision, and so on and so forth. So I'm hoping that like we're at this point where we've created the sort of formal mechanisms we need to sort of transition the board into a directive model. But we're kind of not there yet. And we need people who are interested and willing in getting involved in any way, large or small. And we now have the capability and the sort of mechanisms to make that happen. And sort of, we just need to kind of keep plugging away. That's why I ran for another term. Like my first term sort of culminated in getting these two things done, but that's just the foundation. Like now we're trying to build the house.
Yeah. Perfect. Perfect. So call out to people, if you're in the Django community and you want to get involved and you want to, now's a good time.
now is a really good time. I mean, like I said, there's like this sort of, there is a little bit of a power vacuum, not an entire one, but like a lot of the old heads are less involved or stepping away. And that's scary because it means that people who, you know, have a lot of experience are no longer contributing, but it's also like a super big opportunity because it means that new people bring new ideas and often like honestly better ideas. And so like, you know, have it like there's a moment right now where it's a really good time to get involved. And I don't want to sugarcoat it too much. It's still harder than it needs to be. There's still a number of barriers, you know, there's still some sort of difficulty. I'll make a general offer that anyone who wants to get involved in Django in some way should feel free to reach out to me and ask for help. Like, I can't promise I'll be able to, but I can at least try to point people in the right direction and possibly more than that.
Yeah, cool. It's not the first time, though. Like, I kind of think that Django's kind of at least on its third or fourth and coming up to its fifth generation of active leaders, really. It's not the first time Absolutely. That people have dropped away and a new generation has come in.
Yeah, I'm not worried about it exactly. It's just like something that needs to be focused on because you're right. Like every time we've had sort of like a leadership challenge, we've emerged from it stronger afterwards. And I don't see any reason to suspect that this will be different.
Okay. I've good question. Will, have you got one or?
Yeah, but go ahead.
Okay. So, one thing that we've talked about a few times on the show and perhaps with Haim and others, but is the gap. It still feels to me there's a kind of gap between the narrow Django community of the active contributors, those that are on the forum and, you know, maybe the Discord and around and about, and then the wider community, which is the user base. And do you have any thoughts on how we can sort of, I mean, the social media working group is one great way, I think, but how we can kind of get the bridge out a bit better to... Feels like it's a big gap sometimes.
I mean, I think to some degree that's just true of like software development and open source communities in general, right? Like, you know, for every one person on the forum or listening to this podcast or coming to DjangoCon, there's probably 100, 1,000 who punch in, write Django code for 8 hours, punch out and go home, and that's fine. In fact, that makes me super happy, right? I don't think that just because you write code in your day job, you need to think about it outside of your day job. I'm completely fine with that. And I would love to be able to reach those people to find out what we could do to make their like jobs easier, their lives better, you know, like, I'm not really sure how, but I don't think it's a problem that they're sort of not engaged in the community aspects.
Okay.
The part that I do think about a lot is how do you take the person like, okay, so let's talk about DjangoCon US. I think about half the attendees of DjangoCon US, it was their first time going to a DjangoCon. And most of them had not sort of contributed to at least like the core of Django or like a major sort of popular third-party app in any sort of like concerted way. They all have the interest. They are the vast majority of the people at that conference, you know, several hundred people are sitting in a room, are relatively new to the community, have the excitement, came to the conference, set aside their time, you know, all of that stuff. How do we convert them? How do we help them take the next step? That's something I don't think we've ever done particularly well. And that's the place where I want to really like, I really want to extend the effort. And I don't have answers here. I just have questions, but like it is the foremost thing on my mind right now is like, I've been using the term on ramps. Like, how do we build on ramps into the community? You know, like we consistently get people who kind of like come out of nowhere and build something, you know, something really big and cool and new and exciting. But it's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty big effort. It's a pretty big lift. And it takes like an almost unreasonable degree of confidence to be like, I'm going to write thousands of lines of code and I'm going to get it into Django by force of will, you know, like that should not be required to sort of like get more directly involved. Likewise, you shouldn't have to run for the board of a nonprofit organization to, you know, help out with community leadership or fundraising or governance. You shouldn't have to, you know, plan a conference to get involved in conference organizing, right? Like, you know, how do we build on ramps so that people can dip their toe in contributing to Django, can dip their toe into working on conferences, right? And we have some of those, but we don't have enough, and we don't have like clearly defined like progression paths for various different forms of contribution. And that, so I've been thinking a lot about like building those on ramps.
Yeah. And like people who are good at making contributions to the ORM and writing the docs that they need to do to do that and writing the tests, they may not be good at these other tasks as well. So we need.
I'll give you an analogy. So like a hobby I've started to pick up over the last couple of years is pack rafting. This is combining backpacking and river kayaking. There are these inflatable boats. They're small, they're lightweight. You can fold up, put it in your pack, hike for a while, unfold it, float down a river. It's very hard to get into, like, it requires a lot of backpacking skill. It requires a lot of river skill. White water is dangerous and requires a lot of sort of technical ability in order to like stay out of trouble. So this blogger, and like longtime pack rafter, Dave Chenol, wrote a blog post that he titled something like "Pack Rafting Progression," which is basically like, so you're interested in pack rafting. Here's what it looks like to go from this sounds fun to I am executing like, you know, high difficulty level trips. And he had just sort of these series of like, you know, I mean, step one was like, get obsessed, watch a bunch of YouTube videos, read a lot of books. You know, step two is get a boat, get out on a lake.
A flat
get
lake.
In and out of the boat a bunch, paddle around, you know, figure out how to blow it up, et cetera, et cetera. Like, we need like a contributing to Django progression guide.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. You know, and like that's the type of thing that I'm thinking about.
Marvelous. Will, have you got any questions?
So we're coming up on time, Jacob, but what are the things in Django that you're currently excited about that are in the works, you know, solutions to longstanding problems? Does anything come to mind?
I mean, I mentioned HTMX a little bit earlier. I'm just so excited about it. Like for close to 20 years, it's been like, what is Django's front end story? Django doesn't have a front end story. It's gonna, you know, the sky is falling. You can't do front end development in Django. Django's dead because you can't do front end development in Django. And like almost the first time I saw HTMX, maybe the second time, I think the first time I didn't get it, but probably the second time, and certainly the first site I built in it, it was like, oh no, this is it. Yeah. This is what the front end story for Django looks like.
Yeah.
Like it was like, oh wait, we have an answer now. It's just so easy, and it fits with Django's philosophy. It's not a silver bullet. If you're trying to build something like, I don't know, Figma, like an actual like appy app that runs in the browser, I can't imagine doing that with HTMX. That seems ridiculous. But for the vast majority of what people are building with Django, which is still like database-driven CRUD apps, that's like we still, those are still incredibly important, you know, even in 2024, HTMX really just feels like the missing piece.
Can I just say, I think you told me at DjangoCon that I think you had built basically Excel with Django and HTMX like quickly. Do I have that right?
Yeah, I essentially replaced a workflow that revolved around an Excel spreadsheet with a Django app that had, it was essentially like capturing a bunch of data about our client's security maturity at work. So there's a bunch of, you know, there's a bunch of practices, and we record, you know, yes, no, partial, and a bunch of notes, you know, that sort of stuff. And we had been capturing that in a spreadsheet. And yeah, I built a Django app that, you know, lets people capture that data, includes, you know, I prototyped what we call like multiplayer functionality, letting multiple people update it simultaneously with push sent through server side events. And it, you know, having that level of interactivity was 10% more work than building a sort of old school, you know, form submit workflow. Like it's just easy, and it fits with Django's philosophy in a way that feels like it was designed for building Django apps.
My take when I first started using it, was the way it just literally, like, you just do Django and then you use the HTML, and it's like I haven't changed anything basically in my Django, and it just works. It goes with the grain.
And there are some missing pieces, like I mentioned template partials earlier. Like template partials plus HTMX unlocks the ability to do partial rendering, so that you can have the same view either render a full page or with an HTMX request just render the sort of small snippet that you need to update. That's like a really, that's a thing that's harder than it needs to be right now, in Django. So, you know, there's little bits and pieces that people are sort of reinventing on their own projects and need to be sort of like consolidated a little bit. But by and large, you know, it just sort of magically works, and it's super exciting.
And how are you getting your things online these days? That's, we always like to dig into people.
Yeah, you know, I mean, so I think many people know that I used to work at Heroku, and it makes me really sad that Heroku is still around, but I don't trust it that much anymore. I think it has been, unfortunately, kind of slowly circling the drain for a long time. They had a major security breach about a year ago that really shook my confidence in the platform. And there are a bunch of new things coming out that are kind of like exciting. I'm personally pretty excited about fly.io. But deployment is still like way harder than it needs to be. It's still super, like, you know, we started Django in no small part to like replace PHP, but we still have never come anywhere close to the ease of deployment with PHP. You still can't just throw a Python file on a server and have it work. And like, so many people are, you know, like, you know, deploying, like, most deployment stories, at least at companies now, are like Kubernetes or like the sort of managed services like ECS, like Amazon ECS, or deploying to Lambda. And all of these things are like cool technologies, but boy, they are heavyweight. I still think there's a big gap in the Python community around deployment. People who are interested in this place should play with Deno.land. Deno is a JavaScript variant, kind of, with a deployment environment really baked into the language from the core. It's kind of incredible, and it makes me sad that there's nothing like that for Python. Now, Deno is proprietary, and you're sort of tied into their cloud platform, and it's, you know, it's VC backed, so it's going to turn into crap sooner or later, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah. There's a bunch of reasons why I'm not just going to like say everyone should drop everything and switch to Deno, but like, it does make me sad that we have, you know, 25 years of complaining about how hard it is to deploy Python apps, and it's basically
the same
as hard as it's always been.
Good.
Perfect. Do you have any recommendations for what, well, I'll just personally ask you. So I've taught both Heroku and Fly in my books, and I like Fly a lot, seeing it, but it is also having growing pains trying to recreate Heroku, which, you know, makes sense. It's a lot of work. Specifically though, the lack of a managed Postgres option, like a truly managed one, you know, in Heroku's,
they do have one now, actually.
The Supa base, is that?
No, Fly has like a first party Postgres option now.
They do.
Yeah. It's relatively new, 3 to 6 months. Yeah.
Okay.
The two services that I am keeping a really close eye on are Fly, we mentioned, and Render, render.com. I think right now Render is, if you're new to web deployment, Render is probably your best choice. Fly is a little more complex, a lot more powerful, but it's more of like a set of building blocks than it is sort of like a super slick, clean, easy to use experience. Render is much closer to sort of the Heroku experience, down to sort of like first party managed services like Postgres and Redis and a really Render also has sort of non Docker deployment option. I do like Docker, and I do think containers are a good idea generally, but I hate teaching them to newcomers. I don't want to have to explain what a Docker file is until someone's been writing Python code for a year.
1000%. That was really the biggest thing, is for the 4.2 update for my beginner's book, I switched to Fly, but I had to talk about Docker, and it's like, oh man, it's just,
Fly will now detect a Django app without a Docker file and generate one for you, which is nice. But then you have this, if you're teaching someone, I've been here, you're teaching someone and they go, what is this? And you have to be like, don't look at the man behind the curtain.
That's exactly what it is, right? It's just like, yeah.
And I don't think that's a good experience for newcomers, right? Like telling someone, oh, that's too advanced for you, is like so patronizing and so frustrating, but also it's also true. Like, I actually can't explain this to you right now.
Right. Well, it's like visible enough that they're like, oh, I don't know that. Whereas like, oh, there's so much other stuff you don't know either, but you're not worried about it. But that was, for me, my beginner's book, I wrote it in large part because there was the Rails book, which I don't know if that's still there, where it was like, hello world. And then, you know, Heroku was built for Rails. So it was just like, boom. And I was like, back 10 years ago, like, why can't we do that in Django? Like, Django's awesome. Why can't we do that? And so I've continually been trying to get as close as we can to that. But
there's another project to plug, which is Django Simple Deploy, which is trying to sort of solve this problem for Eric's right app for deploying Django apps. I haven't used it myself because like I have Docker Stockholm syndrome, so I'm like tied into that platform and like it's easy for me now, and I've forgotten that it sucks. I think like I should spend some time playing with it. I've heard good things. I think it's probably a promising idea. And hey, maybe this is one of the exciting new things that someone could take to being built into Django someday. Manage.py deploy would be a pretty amazing thing, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, well, we could go on and on and on. But I think that's, is there any, are we, I was going to ask you what would you change about Django question, but I think you've kind of answered it. So that's the, is there anything, you know, so you do have a day job. We'll put links to it, working on security at Latacora. Am I saying that right?
Yeah, correct.
But people can reach out to you if they have more questions about everything.
Yep, I'm easy to find. Please feel free to reach out to me. My email is fairly obvious. You can DM me on Mastodon, et cetera. I don't get so much random email that it's overwhelming. So please feel free to reach out. Like, I can't promise to respond. I can't promise my response will be helpful, but I can promise that I won't be annoyed or frustrated or any sort of negative emotion. So like anyone who's listening who wants to reach out about anything, please feel free.
Brilliant. That's a lovely.
That's incredibly generous.
Jacob, thank you so much for coming. Really, just such a good chat. I've enjoyed it so much.
Yeah, thanks, guys. I really appreciated it.
So we're djangochat.com, and we will see everyone next time. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.